Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Welcome back. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 2, Communion Part 2. And thank you so much to the new Patreon donors at the Obsessed fan level who just signed up. They'll each be receiving a signed and inscribed copy of the RHPB episode of their choice. And you can too. You've still got a few days. If you join Patreon before midnight this Monday night, June 30th, 2025, you'll get your own signed and inscribed script of your favorite RHPB episode from me to you, your choice. And when you join Patreon, you also get special free merch, you get ad-free episodes, you get monthly bonus episodes, and most important, your donation helps keep us making more episodes of RHPB. So if you've been thinking about donating on Patreon, now is definitely the time. The last couple of bonus episodes have been really great. We had listener Trish Vogel on, and she told us all about her real-life shared death experience, and we talked about those on episode 10 of last season, the episode entitled Glimpses of Eternity. That one just dropped a few days ago, and before that, we had a super rare interview with parapsychologist Stephen Browdy, who talks about his long career as a parapsychologist, and also his friendship with the author of The World of Ted Serios, Jewel Eisenbud, and also Ted Serios himself. He knew both of them and tells stories. It's pretty amazing. So anyway, cool stuff on Patreon. Check it out. Join us if you can. Now, on to today's episode, Communion Part 2. And I didn't know this. One of you brought it to my attention. Part 1 was released on June 13th. It was coincidentally Whitley Strieber's 80th birthday, a total synchronicity. I had no idea. Now, I'm trying to get Whitley Strieber on the show. I want to do a special bonus episode with him for the main feed, but I've been having trouble pinning him down. Every time I try to get in touch, it turns out he's away. And I don't want to read too much into it. I think he's avoiding me. You know, it's always, oh, sorry, I was on board a spacecraft against my wishes. So, you know, didn't have time to return your email. Anyway, if you know Whitley Strieber, put in a good word for me, okay? Let's try to get him on the show. I would love to talk to him. All right, without any further ado, Communion Part 2. Here we go. Communion by Whitley Strieber, Part 2. When the visitors came for Whitley Strieber, it was either the smartest thing they ever did or the dumbest. One of the first questions people always ask about the abductee phenomenon is, why these people? Why is it always some random dude in Arkansas who's out fishing by himself on a Tuesday? Why not abduct a scientist? For the record, they do. Or an influential politician. Yup, them too. Or famous actors or singers or writers. Again, same answer, it has totally happened. But with Whitley Strieber, they may have bitten off more than they could chew. He's certainly blown their cover. Over the past 37 years since Communion was first published, Whitley has written 9 more nonfiction books exploring his ongoing relationship to this phenomenon. If the visitors wanted to remain in the shadows, then I think they picked up the wrong guy. On the other hand, if they were looking to become famous, then yeah, well played, aliens. Like they say, there's no such thing as bad publicity. But these visitors, whatever they are, got even more than that when they came into Whitley's life. They began a relationship with a human being who was anything but passive, anything but a helpless pawn. For one thing, as a writer and a lifelong student of human consciousness, Whitley is someone who is naturally reflective, who instinctually goes to the darkest place in his imagination, and dwells there looking deep into that dark, searching for answers. Once he got past the initial terror and despair of the situation, he became interested in it. He began asking questions. What was happening to him? He searched back through his memories of the visits, both consciously and while under hypnosis, and like all good writers, found himself remembering things. Not just physical details, but emotions. His and theirs. Fleeting impressions. There were moments when he had the distinct impression the visitors were confused, impatient, happy, or even scared. Early on, he felt strongly that the visitors feared him in some essential way, and his suspicion was that they were intimidated by his individuality of thought, personality, and emotion. When they asked him, "What can we do to help you stop screaming?" he recalls, through his own terror, that there was a keen sense of anxiety among his captors. It was observations like these that, when he finally took note of them, led to his rather unorthodox decision. A decision that has had a greater impact on his life, and maybe human history, than anything else. He decided to engage with the visitors. When you or I would probably rack our brains trying to figure out how to cut off communication and never encounter the visitors again, Whitley leaned in. What if I didn't run? What if I turn and face them? Even better, what if I explicitly invite them to come back and see me again? On the one hand, this seems insane, so scary. On the other hand, it might be seen as the psyche's best way to attempt to gain control over a situation that is pretty obviously not under his control. To me, this decision feels recklessly self-destructive. It's one thing to study sharks from a metal cage, and quite another to cover yourself in bloody chum and drift about in the middle of the ocean screaming, "Eat me!" But here we must factor in Whitley's wife, Anne, who from the very beginning not only believed that Whitley's visitations were real, but also fully supported his adventurous spirit. She too saw a chance for deep learning in what her husband was going through, and she agreed that while it was terrifying, it was also a unique opportunity to connect with something truly transcendent, and if Whitley was up for it, she would have his back. In fact, it was she who came up with the title for the book. Quote, "Call it communion," she said, because that is what it's about. While Matt and I were writing our train movie, which at the time was called Rolling Thunder, Matt's high school friend, J.J. Abrams, was also working on a movie. His was called Regarding Henry, and he was in New York, where it was currently in production, with Mike Nichols directing and Harrison Ford in the title role. Every once in a while, Matt would get a call from J.J. while we were working. I could only hear Matt's side of the call, but afterwards, he'd fill me in on whatever was going on in J.J.'s life at that moment. And it was excruciating. I'd met J.J. a few times, and he was a very friendly and an extremely nice guy. But even then, it was obvious that he was so talented, at a level I would never attain. So my jealousy and envy was never based on notions of how he got lucky and didn't deserve the success he was having. He absolutely deserved it. Did Matt and I deserve it? Only time would tell. But in the moment, it was hard. It's what I imagined being on a sports team in college must feel like when you begin to realize that some other athlete is headed to the majors and you most likely are not. It makes you feel foolish for even trying. Every one of his dreams was coming true. While we were sitting in my boiling hot office writing a Die Hard ripoff, he was being rewarded for writing a thoughtful human drama. What the hell were we doing? I was used to going through life feeling like a failure and knowing that the odds against succeeding were 1,000,000 to 1, but I never, ever felt as big a failure, and my life never felt as hopeless as when JJ called. Matt sent JJ the first 20 pages of our script to get his opinion. I was both worried and excited. I was worried that he would think it was shit and that we were stupid for even writing it, but I was excited that maybe he'd love it and somehow that would magically lead to something good happening for us. You know, maybe he'd show it to Harrison Ford and suddenly we'd have a star attached. Stranger things have happened. A few days later, I showed up at Matt's house as he was getting off the phone with JJ. He had read the pages and had thoughts. And I could feel my stomach drop. Among the scenes we had sent him was one in which our hero, Martin Rush, a rail investigator with the National Transit Safety Board, was having an awkward encounter with his ex-wife. It was a scene we both loved because it made our hero seem like a real guy, like in Die Hard when John McClane gets into a fight with his estranged wife, Holly Gennaro. In our script, Martin's ex-wife takes him to task for never being there for their teenage daughter, which we thought was cool because once he and his daughter get on the train and the terrorists take over, his goal will be quite clear, to literally be there for his daughter when the stakes are high and her life is on the line. And because Martin Rush was our hero, we wrote the ex-wife to be a real hard ass, so we'd feel sympathy for him. It was a solid, fun scene, and JJ's note was to change it completely. "Make us love her," he said. This made no sense to me. But Matt went on to explain what JJ had told him. If our hero's ex-wife is a bitch, it doesn't make us love him. It makes us wonder why he married her in the first place. It actually makes us question his judgment in some fundamental way. But if she's a solid, real person, and everyone is trying to make the best of what is clearly a difficult family situation, we'll sympathize with him, and the daughter, and even the ex-wife. We'll care about all of them more. "Don't write her off as a nagging bitch," JJ said. "Make her real. Make us love her." And once it was explained to me in this way, I completely understood it. And I also completely understood why JJ was in New York making a movie with Mike Nichols and I wasn't. When I asked Matt what JJ thought about the action scenes, hoping for some praise, he shrugged and said that JJ said they were fine. I found it so strange that his only note was on a tiny character scene that up until that moment seemed fairly unimportant to me. What it told me was, the character stuff is the most important stuff. Make that real, and the audience will believe all the big, over-the-top, crazy stuff. It's a lesson I've never forgotten. In the aftermath of his initial hypnotic sessions, Whitley knew he could either fall into the role of passive victim, or he could reach a hand into the darkness and greet whatever was so clearly reaching out to him. So, in mid-March 1986, he traveled back from Manhattan up into the woods of upstate New York to the cabin where all this started. He meditated, attempting communication with the visitors. He wanted a response. He wanted confirmation. So he explicitly sent them a message. You want to play? Let's play. They heard him, and they came to him on the night of March 15th, 1986. And when they did, he was ready. They woke him up with a sharp jab on the shoulder. He woke up and was instantly fully conscious. He looked to his left and saw three of them, the short, stocky gray ones standing beside the bed. Whitley thought to himself, my God, I'm completely conscious and they're just standing there. It took him a moment to make a second, more important observation. He knew who they were this time. It wasn't like before when he had no idea what was happening. This was the first time he experienced them as a thing in his life he had encountered before. The next thing he did was attempt independent motion. His plan: reach out and turn on his bedside lamp. But when he tried, he found he couldn't, or almost couldn't. His arm was moving just incredibly slowly, as if through what he called electrified tar. He focused all his attention, all his energy, all his will on this single task, moving his arm. After what felt like an eternity, he reached the lamp, switched it on, and nothing happened. The electricity had been cut off. At this point, he turned back and, in his words, quote, confronted a sight so weird, I thought afterward that I did not know how to write about it. I still don't, so I'm just going to plunge ahead. He was looking at what he felt was a female visitor, taller and thinner than the others. But there was something wrong with this one. Its eyes were like big black buttons, not slanted. Was it wearing a mask? That's when he noticed it was also wearing, get ready, a cardboard imitation of a double-breasted suit, complete with pocket square. It was at this point that Whitley says, I was overcome by terror, so fierce and physical that it seemed more biological than psychological. My blood and bones and muscles were much more afraid than my mind. My skin began tingling. My hair felt like it was getting a static charge. The sense of their presence in the room was so unimaginably powerful and so strange. Despite his fear, he remembered his mission. Quote, I had to communicate in some non-threatening manner. I wanted them to know how I felt about them. I wanted them to know I was still functional and on some level independent. So he did something so unexpected, so badass, that it's like for a moment he became Jim Rockford or Colonel Hannibal Smith from the A-Team. He smiled at them. If he could have, I'll bet he would have lit up a cigar and blown smoke rings in their faces. As it turns out, he didn't have to. The minute he grinned, everything changed. The visitors disappeared in an instant. And Whitley? Well, he fell asleep, of course. The next morning, he remembered everything. And the meaning of what had happened was not lost on him. Quote, the visitors irrefutably announced themselves to me. They allowed me to see them while in full possession of all my other memories of them, albeit in a more or less completely restrained physical condition. I wonder if it all had something to do with my request for confirmation. Because confirmation is what I had asked for, not proof. And it seems that they took me at the exact meaning of the word. By Labor Day weekend, Matt and I were only halfway through Act Two. Parts of the outline weren't working, so we found ourselves spending many nights going backward to solve major story problems, which brought our growing page count to a standstill. We'd work late and then finally stop, feeling exhausted and not sure about what we had accomplished. I wish I could tell you something cool, like then we'd go to a dive bar and drink all night, or to some trendy nightclub where we'd gaze at nocturnal celebrities and dare each other to talk to them. But we did none of that. We'd stand out in front of my house at 2 a.m, in the quiet of my street and the silence of the night, and whisper to each other about specific moments that were or weren't working in the script. And I'll tell you, one night, as we stood talking, an odd, squat vehicle with flashing red and yellow lights turned the corner onto my little street and pulled right in front of us. And before we could even react, a thick hose flopped from a tank in back, and it sprayed a gusher of water onto the sidewalk tree next to us, and then drove off. It was the weirdest, funniest, scariest, most unexpected thing we'd ever seen. Did this happen regularly? Is this how the city made sure sidewalk trees got watered? Matt and I have a low tolerance for the strange. For us, this was every bit as good as a UFO. But my point is, the worry and striving and work and the insecurity of our young writing life was not balanced out by an appropriate amount of Hollywood-style debauchery. No wild one-night stands, no concerts and bars on the Sunset Strip, no cocaine or even booze, no misbehavior of any sort. Just work and jokes and Klondike bars. And more work. The reward, if there ever was to be a reward, would come later, if we suffered enough. But only then, and even then, only maybe. I remember it was very common for me to come home from work at Almanzor Court in the afternoon and find multiple messages from Matt on my phone answering machine. It was almost always him expressing grave doubts about our work from the previous night. But then, a second message might provide hope. He'd come up with a solution. But then a third message would dash that hope, as he found reasons why that solution wouldn't actually work. And regardless of the tone of the final message, when we finally met up later that night, he would likely have flipped back again to the opposite mood. I never knew what to expect. I would be emotionally wrung out before we even sat down at the computer. When we had started on this project months earlier, I thought I had wanted it to be fun, and it was fun. But I came to realize I hadn't really wanted it to be fun. I had wanted it to be easy, and it was never easy. Never. Recently, Whitley Strieber has said that the journey of his life has been to try to sort out what has actually happened to him, what might have happened, and what is clearly a fantasy. Now stick with me, because the fantasy elements aren't what you might think. The majority of his interactions with the visitors he places firmly in the physical reality camp of his lived experiences. So what are the fantasies? The fantasies are memories that he has held of his life that upon even mild reflection he realizes are total lies. Real-seeming events that didn't happen or couldn't have happened, that he now believes are screen memories that are keeping him from clearly remembering something else. Here's one, quote, "A dozen times I have told a story of being menaced by an old college acquaintance whose terrifying appearance and phone calls had driven my wife Anne and I from our 76th Street walk-up to our East 75th Street high-rise, and finally to the Village. A part of this myth is the kindly detective who hypnotized me and enabled me to identify this individual by listening to his voice on a tape. Then we put a stop to his game by simply phoning him back after one of his vicious calls. But it didn't happen. None of it happened. It's just a screen memory. Like the story of the 6 weeks in Florence that never happened. After I realized that I had not actually been there that long, I began to believe another story that I had gone to Russia and then to France and been caught in the French strikes of 1968 without reference to the fact that they ended 2 months before I crossed France. But why do I need these absurd stories? They're not lies. When I tell them, I myself believe them. I don't lie. Perhaps I tell them to myself when I tell them to others, so that I can hide from myself whatever has made me a refugee in my own life. Are these screen memories being provided by the visitors? Or is it Whitley's own brain stitching together some kind of narrative fabric to pull over his past and keep his psyche intact when the real events are too strange and awful? And in case you were wondering, these screen memories are common among all abductees. For abductees, the inverse of a screen memory is missing time. Classic cases involve leaving on a car journey and arriving at your destination long after you expect to. 20-minute drives suddenly last hours, and your memories of it are vague and incomplete. This exact thing happened to Whitley, and not just in a car. He was in London as a student when, quote, I found myself outside a hotel at about 6 in the morning. I went in and booked a room and slept until about noon. After lunch, I went back and found that my room had been let to someone else and my belongings stored in a trunk in the basement. The management was quite put out. They told me that I had said I would be gone for no more than 2 weeks and then had disappeared for much longer since I had not kept up my rent. My room had then been given to another student on their long waiting list. Now, just to be clear, Whitley left his hotel, had lunch, went back, and was informed that he had been gone for more than 2 weeks. What the fuck? It is these stories that make us doubt Whitley's sanity. Or maybe I should say his credibility. More than the ones involving spaceships and the creatures that fly them. And I know of other readers of this book who become frustrated at around this point in the text. Their feeling can be boiled down to, it starts out being a book about a guy who gets abducted by aliens one night, but then it turns out it's been happening his whole life and his family's involved, and then he has huge chunks of his life that never happened or that he doesn't remember or he misremembers and on and on and on. It's too much. It's everything but the kitchen sink. It's like he's afraid the book wasn't long enough. I think what we're reacting to is the implication, the emotional realization that there might be more to this phenomenon than we think. It doesn't strike out of nowhere like a bolt of lightning. It's part of something larger. There actually is a rhyme or reason here, a method to the madness, and our instinctual gut reaction to this is, I am no longer interested. Which I, of course, find interesting. Like the urge to return to sleep after a visitation. It seems completely counterintuitive. However, many people who simply observe a UFO in the sky report being overcome with a feeling of, forget about it, it's not important. It's only later that they realize how strange and inappropriate a reaction it is. In Communion, Whitley Strieber struggles with this. It takes a huge effort of will on his part to face what's happening to him and to not deny it or ignore it, and then actively try to figure it all out. He's the patient and the doctor, the victim and the detective, the man on trial and the judge. Upon multiple readings of the book, You can actually feel him stepping forward to offer testimony and then step back to evaluate it. Long sections of the book are given over to theoretical musings and reflections on ancient archetypes, and that's the writer in him trying to make sense of things and fit his experience into a larger context. This is when his conscious mind takes over and distances himself from the visceral reality of his experiences. And it's hard to parse the results. After all, he's a writer and a human being, and he has to get through the day. How long can your psyche survive nakedly observing your own reactions to difficult situations? At what point do you step back and impose a narrative onto your own life and distance yourself from your own experience for your own survival? By late September, just as the grip of the Los Angeles summer was finally easing, Matt and I hit the home stretch of our script. Page after page of painstaking and minutely choreographed action. Some nights we only did 3 pages instead of our goal of 5. Some nights it was only 2. But it was pure adrenaline-fueled joy. We'd keep reading and rereading the beats to each other and writhing with ecstasy at how brilliantly the sequences were structured and how awesome this movie was going to be. The final pages came together so perfectly that when it was finally done, it came almost as a surprise. Suddenly, we were finished. Now what? Matt had been in touch with a young lawyer named Carl Austin. Neither one of us had an agent at this point, but Carl, who was 25 at the time, making him a couple of years older than us, was eager to help us out and maybe make a name for himself. He read our script, which was now called End of the Line, and loved it. So he took us on as clients. He gave us a few notes, which we did, and by Christmas, it was decided that he would send it out to all major studios on Monday, January 14th. On Wednesday, January 16th, a U.S.-led air and ground war began in Iraq. World War III had arrived. Or again, so everyone thought. People were scared and glued to their televisions to follow the final moments of human civilization. You know what no one was doing? Buying a script about terrorists taking over a train. By the end of February, the first Gulf War was over. And our hopes of selling End of the Line? Well, that was over too. Maybe the most fascinating part of Communion is Whitley Strieber's transcript of a meeting with a group of 11 other abductees, including himself, hosted by Bud Hopkins. At first, Whitley wants no part of it. He, like we, assume it's going to be a bunch of starry-eyed, self-deluded lunatics braying about the divine wisdom they have received from our outer space brothers and sisters. Instead, what he finds is, quote, a group of average people, hard-headed and not unusually imaginative. None of them are seeking publicity. They all demanded anonymity. Among them were a business executive, a hairdresser, a museum curator, a scientist, a musician, a dancer. They clung firmly to the idea that they might have been dreaming. Clung to it, I thought, as a bit of driftwood in a storm. They all shared bits and pieces of their experiences and their feelings about it, and the similarities are shocking and undeniable. They've all seen versions of the same visitors, the same crafts. They all describe telepathic communication with the visitors. They've all been physically examined. More specifically, the ones who describe the examination room even describe the same gray examination table with a solid gray base. But the most extraordinary thing about these people is their emotional ambivalence toward the entire situation. They seem to be saying, yes, I know it's happening. I know it's real. But maybe I'm dreaming. Mostly I try not to think about it. I feel terrible fear in the presence of the visitors, but I also feel a sense of loyalty. I'm appalled by their disregard for us, how they treat us like helpless animals, and I'm indignant at their refusal to explain themselves, what they're doing to us, and why. And yet they also use the words love and longing to express feelings about the visitors. They all remember visitations going back to childhood, as does Whitley. They all live with constant anxiety, specifically performance anxiety. Any kind of audition, test, or questioning can send them spiraling into something like a panic attack. They are all trying to come to terms with the impossible. And for them, it's not theoretical. It's something they have to face every day of their lives. Whitley describes it like this. Those who have had the abduction experience must learn to ride a sort of psychological razor, to accept and reject at the same time. True agnosticism is a very active mental state, a sort of eager unknowing. It's not exactly denial. It's what Fortians do philosophically so that we can read about and talk about strange things and truly enjoy the experience. But for these people, it's very different. For them, it's about their very survival. To fully accept or fully deny this singular, irresolvable part of their reality would be to commit to a level of psychological self-damage they're just not ready to endure. So they remain in between two states. They are Schrodinger's abductees. Until objective reality steps up with a definitive answer to what they're experiencing, they wait and worry. Which answer will hurt less? Which will hurt more? It gets worse. Beyond the ubiquitous saucer-shaped craft and the little bug-eyed aliens and their magic wands, there are two other features of visitor encounters that are so common they must be considered almost standard. The first is a message of impending apocalypse. The visitors showed Whitley images of the Earth in flames as if from a nuclear holocaust. But just as often it comes in the form of warnings about environmental disaster. Footnote, it isn't lost on anyone, including Whitley, that before becoming aware of his lifelong relationship with the visitors, he co-authored two books, War Day and Nature's End, that dealt respectively with the results of a nuclear war and an environmental catastrophe. It's unclear if the visitors' warnings are so that we can somehow avoid the situations, or if these images are presented as future history. This is going to happen. It's inevitable. It's a foregone conclusion. And that's why we need your sperm and eggs and fetuses. Because we need to get the other planet up and running with humans and human hybrids so that once you destroy yourselves, it's not the end of your race. You're welcome. This, of course, is the second constant factor in alien abductions. A relentless dedication to the collecting of sexual material from humans. A large majority of abductees have experienced it. It's the one area in which the visitors seem to intentionally tip their hands. And while none of them have ever sat down and explicitly said this to any abductee, as far as I know, it's all too easy to put together a narrative. The visitors come from the future, or a parallel dimension in which they are aware of our future. They have come to rescue the human race from itself. They can't stop us from poisoning ourselves or blowing ourselves up. That's definitely gonna happen. So instead, they have selected certain genetic lines that interest them, and they're visiting those families generation after generation and taking them on board their ships and extracting sexual material from them to somehow facilitate a continuation of our race somewhere else. Now, if you have a better theory, I'd love to hear it. Soon after the non-sale of End of the Line, Our lawyer, Carl Austin, scheduled a lunch meeting between Matt and I and two young independent producers named Jeffrey Newman and Martin Wiley. They were interested in optioning our script. For $1,000, they would have 6 months to try to set it up somewhere. At the time, they were pursuing a deal with JVC, the Japanese electronics manufacturer, because JVC was interested in producing films that could go straight to video, which made sense because they manufactured VCRs and VHS tapes. But before any option deal could be made, Martin and Jeffrey insisted on some rewrites, and their major note was that our main character, Martin Rush, should be reimagined as an ex-Navy SEAL. This was both the beginning of the beginning and the beginning of the end of the line. At the time, there were two kinds of action movies. There were the die-hard kind, a movie about an underdog hero who's hanging on by his fingernails the entire movie but just refuses to quit. He's scared, he's hurt, but he never gives up. These movies were not fundamentally about swagger, and the heroes, while heroic, seemed human. The other kind of action movie usually starred someone like Arnold Schwarzenegger, or Sylvester Stallone, or Chuck Norris, or Clint Eastwood. And they typically were about swagger. The heroes seemed unstoppable, and strangely unperturbed by the violence occurring all around them, and because of them. These movies owed a lot of their origins to one man. Bond. James Bond. You never really doubted the outcome. You just sat back and enjoyed the mayhem. End of the Line was definitely the first sort of action film. We always joked that the worst possible thing that could happen was for someone to turn our script into a movie about 20 terrorists who picked the wrong train to hijack. Now, of course, we were being asked to do that ourselves. We went to Carl Austin and said we didn't want to do it. If some big studio wanted to pay us a gigantic sum of money to buy the script and then have somebody else rewrite it, that was one thing. But now, here we were, being asked to dismantle our own script ourselves and for practically nothing. Carl Austin's advice was basically, don't be idiots. The fact of the matter was, no studio had bought our script. So rather than pouting and taking our ball and going home, why not do the notes we didn't like, but do them in a way we did like? And besides, who is to say that this wouldn't be the rewrite that would suddenly make it a script that studios would buy for a huge sum of money? Matt and I realized that he was right. So as much as we could, we got over ourselves and rewrote our script. Oh, Martin and Jeffrey had one other idea. Retitle the movie to Dark Territory. Over the next year and a half, Martin and Jeffrey kept renewing their option and tossing us a few more bucks and asking us for further rewrites. They kept getting close to setting it up, but never quite close enough. And as the end of the final option period was coming to a close, Matt and I decided that we'd had enough and would not renew it again. The process had been demoralizing. With each rewrite, the script got further and further away from the thing that had made us so happy almost 2 years ago. God, how I missed those late-night writing sessions. The smell of Jack's flea shampoo. The joy of writing a perfectly structured action scene. And singing A Whole New World at the top of our lungs. But then, a month before the option ran out, something happened that changed everything. Martin and Jeffrey met a producer named Gary Goldstein. At the time, Gary Goldstein was the manager of writer J.F. Lawton, who had two huge movie successes to his name, Pretty Woman and Under Siege. Gary knew that Warner Brothers wanted to make a sequel to Under Siege. They had contracted writers to produce a script, but were also actively looking for outside scripts that could possibly be purchased and adapted to their needs. Gary read our most recent draft of what was now called Dark Territory and said he thought it might have a shot. Matt and I were excited, and horrified. If Dark Territory became a Steven Seagal movie, we knew it would never be the movie we had wanted it to be. In many ways, it would be the exact opposite. But at the same time, it might be a huge sale. And at least then we might be paid back for what was now more than 3 years of practically free work. Matt and I did a final free rewrite for Gary Goldstein at the end of 1992 with the understanding that the script would go to Warner Brothers sometime early in the new year. This turned out to be an incredibly stressful time for Matt and I. As January crawled along and we did everyone's last-minute notes, we found that we were more deeply ambivalent about what was happening than ever. On the one hand, we wanted it to be real. We wanted to succeed. We wanted to make a big Hollywood sale. But at the same time, if it did happen, it would also be our worst nightmare. We would be the guys who weren't even selling an original script. It would be a sequel. And not to Die Hard, it would be a sequel to a Die Hard ripoff. In fact, our fear was that that's exactly how it would be perceived in the industry, as a ripoff of a ripoff. We had put so much love and care into our original draft, but now we risked being seen as a couple of cheesy hacks. What had gone wrong? How had we gotten so far off track? We were stuck between two questionable outcomes, and we really didn't know where we wanted to land. As it turned out, we didn't have long to wait to learn our fate. The script went into Warner Brothers on Friday, February 19th. In Hollywood, everything takes forever. We were told it could be weeks before they made their decision, but not this time. The top brass read our script over the weekend, and their decision was instantaneous and unanimous. They wanted it. We sold Dark Territory to Warner Brothers on Tuesday, February 23rd, 1993. Our brilliant script was destined to be a Steven Seagal movie. So, of course, on the day we've been waiting for all our lives, the day we finally legitimately became a part of Hollywood, we were disappointed and depressed. It was such a surreal moment. I was over at Matt's house as we looked at our names in the Hollywood Reporter and Variety for the first time in our lives, and we felt like the biggest losers in the world. We'd worked so long and so hard and come so far, and for what? Even the money was disappointing. For now, we'd be splitting 50 grand, just $25,000 apiece. There was a knock at the door. Someone dropping in on Matt? This never happened. We both wandered through the dining room to the front door. Matt opened it. It was JJ, and he was holding a bottle of champagne. Congratulations, you guys! You did it! We quickly ushered him inside, embarrassed by his excitement. We set the champagne aside and then explained to him why his congratulations were misplaced. We'd barely made any money on the deal. There had been no bidding war, and the script was destined to be degraded as it was turned into a Steven Seagal movie. This was no time for celebration. JJ looked at us, stunned. Then he said, "You guys are idiots. You sold a movie. You're on the cover of Variety and The Hollywood Reporter. Do you have any idea how many people are reading that today and wishing they were you?" JJ went on, telling us that whether we liked him or not, Steven Seagal was a major star, and if this movie got made, which it definitely would, it would be a huge summer release, and that meant something. There is no world where what happened today is anything less than an amazing, fantastic, unbelievably good thing, he said. And if you can't enjoy it, you might as well quit the business now, because this is one of the good days, one of the best days, and there's gonna be a lot that aren't. Everyone tells you how to deal with failure, but no one ever tells you how to deal with success, how you're supposed to feel, or even what it is. Matt and I had spent so much time in the habit of feeling bad that we just continued with that. It seemed so much safer than celebrating, because we knew that it's when you're celebrating that God bends down and grabs the edge of the rug you're standing on. JJ held up the bottle of champagne and said, "So, are we going to drink this or not?" Matt and I looked at each other. Should we celebrate selling out? Should we celebrate a dream coming true, even if it wasn't exactly the dream we'd hoped for? Should we celebrate the beginning of a process that was going to be hard and promised any number of future disappointments? Should we celebrate all of those hopeless nights, staring at the blinking cursor, inhaling Jack's flea shampoo, eating Klondike bars, and thinking we would never sell this thing, and asking each other that same age-old question? What can I do to make you stop screaming? Should we celebrate that scariest thing of all? Happiness? We did. In the newly written introduction to the 2022 paperback edition of Communion, Whitley Strieber uses two words that didn't appear in the 1987 edition. They describe his experience of the past 37 years with the visitors. The two words are Stockholm Syndrome. Stockholm Syndrome is a coping mechanism to a captive or abusive situation. People develop positive feelings toward their captors or abusers over time. Whitley acknowledges it might be a factor for all abductees, himself included. Getting used to the visitors and welcoming them, because he says, quote, "There isn't really going to be any way for us to control the situation. How can we devise weapons or procedures that are effective in controlling somebody who can flicker in and out of reality?" Whitley Strieber has tried to make peace with a situation over which he has no control. He has done this by making a courageous decision. If they're going to come, he's going to meet them. Maybe he believes he's the one the visitors will write their books about. Maybe he's the one they'll think about and wonder about and worry about as they try to drift off to sleep in whatever place they call home. I hope so. I had always assumed that once I made my first sale, things would change. Or, at the very least, I would change. I would never again be haunted by feelings of insecurity, fear, and fundamental questions about my own self-worth. But that wasn't the case. Those feelings went away, or at least shut up, for a little while. But then they came back. And that has been the story of the last 30 years. Moments of success and confidence and strength are shuffled among a larger number of moments that are their opposite. As it has been for Matt, as it has been for JJ, and maybe even Steven Seagal. Certainly as it has been for every writer, director, and actor that I know personally. Here at the far end of my career, I realize that you never truly arrive. You never stand at the center of your realized dreams. Or if you do, you don't do it for long. But I've only been able to move forward and make it through the bad days by tricking myself into believing that I was, in some essential way, in control. In control of the quality of my writing. In control of the trajectory of my career. But deep down, I know I'm not. So over the years, I've learned to step out to the cliff's edge and close my eyes and jump into the water far below. After all, without risk, what's the value of reward? And frankly, without fear, where's the fun? Like Whitley Strieber, and all of you too, I engage every day in a dance with a dynamic and unknowable universe, one that is never still and never without surprises. Do I know the dance? No. Am I even a good dancer? No. So it makes no rational sense, my belief that somehow, if I just keep dancing, the music will carry me, and joy will somehow be the result. but I guess we all believe what we have to survive. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Please join us next time when we get into one of our darker episodes and a story that spans decades, two of the best decades, the 70s and the 80s, as we get into Daniel Cohen's young adult classic, Monsters, Giants, and Little Men from Mars. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Until next time, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Ugh. Spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.